Welcome to the Brilliant Business Moms Podcast, episode 54, with Sarah Kornack and Bethann Schwamberger. Today on the show, we're talking with author Caroline Starr Rose. Caroline walks us through her journey to being published. And if you've ever wanted to be a published author, then this is the episode for you. I also love the tenacity with which Caroline pursued her big dream, and I know you will find it impressive too. So let's get started.
You're listening to the Brilliant Business Moms Podcast, practical business advice for startup moms.
Today on the show, we are pleased to welcome author Caroline Starr Rose. As a child, she lived in various parts of the world, and as an adult, taught English and social studies in various states. Currently, she resides in New Mexico with her husband and two boys. Caroline's first published book, Maybe, was released in 2014, and she has two additional books being published in 2015. Welcome to the show, Caroline.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to chatting with you today.
So, Caroline, you have had a long journey towards becoming a published author. Can you tell us a little bit more about that journey?
Absolutely. For as far back as I can remember, I have wanted to write, but I didn't really get serious until the summer of 1998. I had been teaching sixth grade in Orlando, Florida, and just a few weeks before the school year ended, I showed my kids a video with Roald Dahl. And it was a video where he was talking about how he would go about his daily writing. And he had a couple of tips that I just thought were really, really wonderful. His tips were to write for 2 hours every day, whether you had something to say or whether you had nothing to say. He would force himself to sit with his work for 2 hours, and he would always stop at an exciting place so that when he would pick up his work again the next day, it wouldn't be so difficult to get started. Now, his third bit of advice is something I've never done, but he wrote all of his books, believe it or not, on yellow legal pads, which is kind of a fun, a little fun fact about him. But I went home that summer and I thought, you know, I can do this. If 2 hours a day, if I sit down with an idea, you know, that's not hugely, that's not kind of an overwhelming task. That's a doable sort of thing. So I spent about 2 weeks researching the Oregon Trail. And after that, I was an absolute expert, which is just such a joke. But I spent these 2 weeks of research, and then I wrote a novel. And it was awful, and it was really hard, but it was a great, great learning experience. And it kind of set me up for this structure of writing during the summertime, revising during the school year, and then sending things off in the mail. Back then, it was through the mail to editors also during the school year.
How many books did you send off before they accepted Maybe?
May was my fourth novel. So I had written three others, obviously, before, if we can do the math. And I'd also written six picture books along the way as well. So that was roughly 10 manuscripts, 12 years of writing before I was offered a deal.
Caroline, I did check out your book, Maybe, at my library.
And wonderful. I love that your library had it.
Yeah, I know. I was so excited, too, to think that a person we were going to interview on our podcast, I could literally go into my library, and it is not a very big library, and find your book right there on the shelf, which for me was exciting, so I can't imagine how exciting that must be for you.
I have to confess, the first time I saw a copy at my home library, oh, this is so embarrassing. I walked in, there was this poor unsuspecting girl. I pointed to it, and I said, I wrote that book. And I ended up sending her home with it. And poor thing, she probably thought, who is that crazy woman who made me take this book with me? But I couldn't help myself. It was so thrilling.
It must have been thrilling. I had never read a novel in verse before, but I really enjoyed it. What motivated you to write Maybe in that style?
That's a really great question, because I had read two verse novels before I started May. And the conventional rule of thumb is you need to read at least 100 books in your genre or format before attempting to write in that particular style. So I knew I was writing historical fiction, you know, that fabulous first attempts with the Oregon Trail that I talked about earlier. And this was my second attempt at historical fiction. And so I felt like this was a genre I knew well. I loved it. I'd done all my research, and I was sitting down to begin my first draft. And I was really frustrated with the distance I felt between the ideas in my head and what I was actually putting on the page. So I went ahead and set the draft aside and went back to my research. And what I discovered, specifically one book in particular really spoke to me. It was a book that was called, oh gosh, let's see if I can remember it, Read This Only to Yourself, The Private Writings of Midwestern Women, I believe is what it was called, which just thrilled me because I'm actually a really nosy person. And that's one of the many reasons I loved teaching history and now enjoy writing historical fiction. I can read people's private letters and just call that work. You know, it's not a rude sort of thing to do. Of course, it's, you know, rude to do something like eavesdrop in a restaurant, but when you're writing books and you're doing research, you can dig into firsthand accounts like that. So anyway, I went back to this book and was just really struck by the patterns that I found that these frontier women used to communicate with each other, either through letters or through their private writings like journals. Language was very spare. It was very careful. Today we use a lot of, exclamations, adjectives, everything is a big deal. We, you know, lots of kind of drama in the way that we communicate with each other. And there was none of that. Whether people were talking about something awful, like the death of a child, or something mundane, like laundry, or something celebratory, like a wedding, the language was all very controlled and contained. And I really felt like I was struck by a bolt of lightning. And when I talk to it to this day, it gives me chills. I realized if I could capture this aspect of communication, if I could really mirror the voices of these women, I could tell this story most truthfully. I could access Mae Betterly's life really directly, and this would be the best way to tell the story. Now, I wasn't really ready to tell myself I was writing a verse novel because that was really terrifying, having only read two. But I do remember a few weeks after I started in earnest on this, I talked to my mom on the phone and she said to me, you know, what are you working on? I tried to explain it to her. I said, I don't really know what to call it, but it feels like the most honest thing I've ever written.
Wow, that's just really incredible. I love the way you described that piece of artwork that you've created, that it was the most honest thing you've ever written. That's, I just love that.
Thank you.
Before we move on from maybe, at the end of the book, the Mr. Chapman,
yes.
I picture him as a young guy, possibly a future romantic character.
Yes, I am asked this sometimes. And yes, without kind of, you know, there's this weird balance here because we're in a different era now.
Yeah, I
pictured him, well, Mae is 12, so gosh, even saying this out loud just sounds wrong. But again, this is a different era. He might have been in his late teens, maybe the very earliest, his early 20s. I see that too. And I did want to not really heavily hint at anything like that, but I did want to leave the possibility open for readers to see something like that, because I feel like this is really the first opportunity she's ever had to have a meeting of the minds where she has not been judged by past performance. And a lot of her experience, I find her a really interesting character because, and my characters are real to me, so I talk about them like real people, so you're going to need to forgive me. But what I find is really interesting about Mae is so much of who she is has been defined by other people. Now, some of that has been direct, you know, for example, teacher. The things that teacher said to her would have been about her reading in particular. She's a dyslexic girl. That has certainly helped define who she is. But a lot of who she is has been kind of placed on her indirectly, what she thinks other people are thinking about her. And a lot of this comes back to her reading and her inability to read well, even though she's a very intelligent girl. And I really think this is, especially in middle school, this is such a kind of a key time when kids are starting to determine who they are, what makes them who they are, how their abilities or disabilities define them. And swinging back around again to Mr. Chapman, he doesn't have that past with her. He simply sees her as who she is in this moment. And as I said, it really is a meeting of the minds. I think that they, in a lot of ways, are intellectually equal. And I think there is possibility for that, maybe way down the road for the two of them.
So in your guest post for Ann Bogle's How She Does It series, I love that you said you were in the apprentice stage for many years. Can you explain that thought a little more?
Absolutely. And this is actually something that I didn't fully understand at the time myself. It took a friend of mine a few years ago who was giving a talk about what I'll call the writing life, who used the terminology. And I thought, gosh, I really wish I could have used this label myself, you know, 10, 15 years ago. It would have helped me tremendously. But the apprentice stage would be those early years where you're really trying to find your way. So many of us, when we're looking for some sort of career, let's say, for example, if you're, well, like my past, I've been a teacher. And so I went to college. I got the degree in education. I did my student teaching. You know, I read up on teaching, but mainly I had the opportunity, like everybody else, if they wanted to go into education, to sit through 4 years of school, to do the practical training, and then to go out there and get the job. And writing largely is not like that. There are some people who pursue MFAs, Master of Fine Arts degrees in writing. Some people have taken creative writing in college. I haven't done any of those things. And so I am largely a self-taught author, as many, many, many people are. And so this apprentice phase idea, going back to those years, I was just kind of finding my way. I was writing. I was reading books on craft. This is before the internet, so there weren't, you know, blogs, author blogs and agent blogs and those sorts of things. I was reading writing magazines, and I was spending a whole lot of time either revisiting the books that I loved as a girl, getting familiar with new titles on the shelves. And this was especially convenient with picture books because I had two young boys at home at the time. So I would just, you know, lug home that 50 book limit that I could take home. And as I would read with the boys afterward, I would go back and I kept a notebook with each page had a different publisher. And then I would learn the publisher's imprints as well. If you don't know what an imprint is, a publishing house's, imagine like, let's say Penguin Random House, for example. Penguin and Random House merged about 18 months ago. So they are now the largest of the big five publishers out there. And so you can break Random House into Penguin, or Penguin Random House into both Penguin and Random House. And from there, they have a number of imprints, which would be little individual, almost publishers within the publishing house that each have their own style, their own flavor, their own flair. And they function independently as well. So I was getting familiar with what imprints published, what kinds of books. There might be ones that were more commercial. There might be some that were more interested in beautiful art. And so these were the things that I was really trying to teach myself in those apprentice years.
When I read that on Ann Bogle's How She Does It series, that really resonated with me. And I think it could resonate with so many people in lots of different fields.
Exactly.
Especially in entrepreneurial fields where everything is kind of learn as you go. So I love that imagery of we're all just apprentices here learning how to do things. So through the years, as you sent off manuscripts and got no's in response, how did you and your family handle those rejections? How did you keep going through that?
I like the term maniacal optimism. That has kind of been my mindset. And you don't quite know, and this is the honest truth, are you pursuing something that is a dead end? Is this, you know, that's the maniacal part here. Are we getting a little crazy? Or in the pursuit of this dream, are you just feeling so strongly that this is what I want and my work can only get better if I continue to try? That really was the thing that kept me motivated. I really felt like it can only get better if I continue. And if the worst thing you can tell me is no, my gosh, I really have learned that no is not that bad. It really is not the scary thing that you think it is. And in fact, it's made me brave to ask for things that I wouldn't have, you know, thought of at other times. I will say this was not always easy for my husband. I would run to the mailbox. I mean, it was like a ritual. If the mail truck drove up, I was out there. I was out the door. And again, this is, I started my submissions before there was such a thing as email submissions, which has just made things so much faster and easier. You know, there were submissions I waited a year and a half on to hear back. And I would go to the mail docks every day as if it were my birthday. And I was 10 years old. I mean, just that anticipation daily for 12 years, if you can imagine.
Wow.
And it was emotionally draining, as you can imagine as well. But it wasn't always easy for my husband to watch this because he saw the rejection, hundreds and hundreds of rejections over the years. I remember him saying to me once, is this what you want to keep doing? And how can you keep doing this? How do you decide when you stop? Because you've been told no again and again. And I think that's when especially this idea of the apprentice phase would have been really helpful for the two of us, because I was learning. And, you know, you don't tell somebody who's in their third year of teacher training, well, when are you going to get your job? You know, but that's the same sort of thing. I was learning along that phase. And I, until I got my work right, it wasn't ready to be accepted. But I didn't fully know that yet. And he didn't fully know that yet. I don't know if anybody really understood that apart from the editors I was sending things to. And so I guess what really just kept me moving was a love for the stories, a curiosity about what would happen next. And again, this maniacal optimism that someday the next story, the next editor, those would be the one. And, you know, and I, through 10 books, through hundreds of rejections, through 12 years, that was what kept me moving.
We're so glad you kept going, because now, of course, you've written an incredible novel with more on the way. So I love that story. And so many women and just artists of all types will be encouraged by that. And, you know, the fact that you did improve with every rejection or every page that you wrote. So it's incredible.
Thank you.
So, Caroline, through all of I feel bad even saying this, we keep mentioning the rejection. let's bring this up. Now you're a published author, so why do we keep bringing up the rejection? But we were curious, through the no's that you received, you still continue to shoot towards a traditionally published book, even as becoming self-published became, you know, more of a popular thing over the last few years. What made you decide to continue down that traditionally published route?
And likewise, I hope this doesn't sound snobby in any sort of way. That was just what I had hung my hat on. I was going to have a traditionally published book. And also, I have read many, many self-published books that are very well done, so I mean no disrespect in any way. I will say this, though, there is no way I could ever do this alone. And I'm not just talking the marketing. I think sometimes people think, oh, when you're traditionally published, one of the hugest things, you are your own boss, which is brilliant, but you also have a tremendous amount of work. I think a lot of times, though, people just look at that as from the side of once the book is available to the public, you are the one who's doing the push. And that is certainly true. But before that book is published, the amount of work, the number of people who have put their hands on the things that I've written, it is unbelievable. And if I were to ever release something that only I had touched, oh my word, for me, it would be awful, because I am not capable of creating my best work on my own. So again, no disrespect to those who do self-publish and do so beautifully. I am incapable of that. My editor has been, my wife's had several editors up to this point. I'm working with my fourth now. Editors serve as professors. I feel like when I go through the process working with an editor, it's like an intensive one-on-one course designed just for me. My editors are able to find my flaws, my weaknesses, see the patterns of things that I don't do well, help me to discover them and then to move in a new direction. They're able to point out the things I do well that I might not necessarily have known about myself, and have shown me how to develop those more fully. And just to think of doing that alone, I couldn't. I could not produce anything worth your time, really and truly.
So for everyone listening, I'm sure there are women out there who have a book and the thought of being published by a publisher would just be amazing for them. What does that process of finding a publisher and getting your book published look like? How do they start on that process?
I will start with saying I have an agent, and so you can get published still in the children's market without an agent. It is possible. In fact, there are a handful, I can only think of one off the top of my head, who still do publish well and traditionally and often without an agent, but it's really hard. I wouldn't recommend going that route. So first, finding an agent was a huge boon for me and was a turning point. Second of all, though, once your book is sold, once the agent has submitted it to editors, and what an agent does is, an agent really is your advocate, your business partner, and somebody who knows, who has the contacts that you don't have. So my agent then looked through her list of contacts and decided, you know, who would be the best fit for this book. She then submitted the book to those editors, and then they were able to say yes or no to it. The process of going back years when I was waiting for the mail daily, an agent also really speeds things up because they are already seen in the industry as somebody in the know. They already have earned their stripes. They have contacts. And they can also say, I need to hear from you in the next 2 weeks, or I need to hear from you in the next 2 months. And then they can do some nudging as well. So that is really nice. These are things that a plain old author really isn't able to do on their own. But let's say the book has sold. If you're working with a novel, the standard timeline, probably the fastest you'll ever see a novel printed, would be 12 months after it sells. And that would be lightning speed fast. Most novels are, once they sell, published 18 months after sale. It might be as long as 2 years after their sale. And if you're talking picture books, it gets even trickier because it's not just the author that is doing the work. An illustrator then is brought in, and their work takes a tremendous amount of time. They have to, just like the author goes through rounds of revision, the illustrator does as well. And so, for example, I have a book coming out next July called Over in the Wetlands, and my illustrator, his name is Rob Dunleavy. I know that he turned in 32 sketches of the pictures that will go with our book, and some were approved, some were not approved. He had to then, you know, do his revision work and then have those initial sketches approved. And then he had to go back and do the final art. So that book, my editor expressed interest in that book at the end of 2011. Actually, it was just a few weeks before Maybe was published in 2012. So I think the official sale was January 2012. That book will come out again in 2015. So, my goodness, 3.5 years after the sale date.
Wow, that is a long turnaround time. I had no idea. How long have you been working with your agent, and how do people go about finding an agent to work with?
I'm working with my second agent. My first agent was a lovely lady. We amicably parted ways about 2 years ago. And so I've been with this agent. Her name is Tracy Adams of Adams Literary. I've been with her about 2 years. So I signed with my first agent in 2009. That was a huge turning point for me. I dabbled up to that point, all those years of rejection. I dabbled with sending stories off to agents, but I erroneously thought, oh, this is just kind of like an extra step that I don't really need to do. If I could send things straight to the editors, you know, that's my in. I don't want to have some extra extraneous step. And really, that was faulty thinking, because an agent isn't just there for the one book. An agent is there for, ideally, the life, your life as a published author, and then will continue to represent your work into the future. So how I found my agent, my first agent, was through a website that is run by Writer's Digest, the magazine, which is a fabulous resource. All writers should pick up that magazine at some point in time, Writer's Digest. And the blog is called the Guide to Literary Agents blog, or the GLA blog. And I discovered her because she was new and she was hungry. Those are the two words that really resonated with me. New agents are often looking for new clients, and she was willing to read my work. Now, I had, at that point, I think had gotten 80 agent rejections when I really got serious about finding an agent. I think I was around rejection number 80 when Michelle took me on. So you never know. Again, a no, you only need one yes. The no's aren't fun, but you really only do need one yes.
That's exactly right. Well, you've given us some great advice already for the aspiring authors among us, but do you have any more advice for those apprentice authors out there who are still honing their craft?
Absolutely. Just as I did, reading, 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 I strongly recommend people, and again, this is from, I can only speak from the children's literature perspective, but I hope this will kind of trickle down into people writing for maybe the adult fiction market, maybe even not the nonfiction market. I really recommend people, and this is also what industry professionals say too, read the books that were published in the last 5 to 10 years. Now, this is not in any way to indicate that classics are worthless. Does not mean that at all. But what it does mean is you have a sense of what is selling now and the sorts of books that agents and editors will be interested in the here and now. Writing styles do change. Think of those books that you adored as a child. I have read and reread everything by Lucy Maud Montgomery. She wrote the Anne of Green Gables books.
Yes.
I've read them all.
Yes.
Read Lucy Maud's, or actually she went by the name Maud. I have read Maud's journals twice now, and she kept a journal from the time she was 14 until she died in her 60s. And that is a practice I'm going to, every 10 years I've decided I will reread these journals. They just are amazing. So her books are amazing, but most likely they wouldn't have sold today in the form that they are now. And again, that's not to say, oh, these are inferior books and the classics are worthless. Not at all. But the pacing has changed over the years. The way we use description has changed over the years, especially writing for children. And I know this probably sounds like I'm blaming computers or something. I'm not. But, you know, we have this short attention span and this sort of thing. It's not just that, though. It is you want to have ideally your reader never sticks a bookmark in that book. And ideally, that reader picks up the book and just stays with it. And so you are really responsible as the author to hook them and keep them moving through your story. And that was not necessarily the case with books that were written 100 years ago or even 15 years ago. So writing styles, writing preferences have changed. Get familiar with books published in the last 5 to 10 years, maybe even the last 2 to 3 years. Read plenty of books on craft. I cannot recommend a handful to you that have been instrumental to me. Of course, they're not in front of me, so let's see what I can pull out of my head. One by an author named Cheryl Klein, who is out of who works with Scholastic. Her book Second Sight is phenomenal. I've read it a few times. I've actually taught a novel revision class largely based on her book. She also runs a podcast with, a gentleman named, I can't think of his name, but he comes from the screenwriting perspective. She comes from the editor perspective working with children's books. And that podcast is called Narrative Breakdown, which is fabulous. It's definitely worth listening to if you are in this apprentice stage. Other books I can recommend, Mary Cole's Writing Irresistible Kidlit is Mary Cole's book. I love Darcy Patterson. She has written a book called Novel Metamorphosis, which is about taking a draft and then working through it with revisions. Darcy also offers a novel revision weekend retreat if you can ever participate in one of those. It's a wonderful, wonderful affair. Oh my goodness, I can't believe I've forgotten this. If you are an aspiring children's author, you have to stop everything now and go and join SCBWI. That is the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. I joined, I think, in 2003. I don't know what took me that long, other than I had no earthly idea. I was stumbling around in the dark on my own for so long. I knew no one else who was trying this thing called writing. And looking back through notes I had taken once I did finally join SCBWI, I saw that I had written down once or twice, look into this group. It is a phenomenal international organization. And the first time I attended a meeting, I knew I had met my people. And it just, spending time with these people, it was an opportunity for me to be fueled for another year to keep going.
Those sound like some amazing resources. I'm sure that would be very useful to some of our listeners. Has your blog played a factor in getting published or getting found?
It has not. And I will say that in the children's market, this is one of those things that is different from the nonfiction market. People that do have a large following and plan to write nonfiction, they sometimes are discovered through their blogs. I have a very, very modest blog following. I love blogging, though. One of the things I love the most about it is, as you can imagine, all these years of rejection and then the delay time from selling a book and then actually seeing it on the shelves, as it can be several years. The fact I can stick a post out and someone can respond in minutes, that is thrilling to me. That is just really satisfying. But my blog did not draw any attention from editors or agents. I will say, however, when I was querying agents, and then when my agents then sent my work on to editors, I would see that I would get hits from Scholastic or from Random House. And so having a web presence, once you're at the point when you're ready to submit work, is an important thing to have.
That's really good to know. And I love what you said, too, about the blog being another way for you to find joy in your work, that immediate level of feedback. It's that encouragement that keeps you going, the same way that Society for Children's Writers can do that. So that's a really interesting perspective. So Caroline, as a now published author, and maybe you could share both sides of this, I'm curious to know what a day in the life looks like for you right now in terms of continuing to work on your writing, the different tasks you have to do in working with your agent and editor and things like that. And then maybe also share how you were able to keep up this craft as a mom with young children at home.
Sure. I don't have any typical days. We'll start by saying that. Most days start with either a run or a trip to the gym. It is really nice now that my boys are in school. I do have a window of time that is mine alone. What I wrote in the guest post for Anne talked a lot about trying to find those nooks and crannies of time when my boys were young and how challenging that could be and how I had to really let myself realize 10 minutes, if I've got 10 minutes today, that is going to be enough. I need to be satisfied with that. I can't let that discourage me, because then the next day I might not try again. But I am fortunate in that I am at the point where both my boys are in school. After I have that exercise time, I can kind of get down to work. And it depends on whatever is on my plate right now. If I have work back from my editor, that is what I need to tackle first, because there's some sort of deadline. So, for example, the end of last month, I turned in a new manuscript to my editor. When I sold the book that comes out next March, which is called Bluebirds, it was actually a two-book deal. And this was a learning curve for me. I had never had an experience like this before. So again, maybe this is like apprentice stage 2.0, constantly in learning mode as I continue with my job, which is a good thing. I think we all should be doing that. But what that meant was, when I was working on Bluebirds with my editor and then sent it back to her, in those in-between times, which sometimes could be as long as 3 months or could be as short as 2 weeks, I was working on the second novel. And because I do write historical fiction, that meant that I had research to do, and then I had drafting to do, and it was kind of tricky. It was not always easy, but it was a great, great experience. So I turned in that second book at the end of September. I will expect to see that again in a few months. And so now I am working on other things. I spent a few weeks kind of housekeeping, if you will. I'm working on some blog posts for when Bluebirds comes out next March. I had something that I needed to fill out for Penguin Random House called my author questionnaire, which is everything from the address of my hometown newspaper to what people do you know that might be interested in reading this book? How can we promote this book to booksellers and this sort of thing? And that was in anticipation of talking with my publicist for the first time, which will happen sometime next month. And again, this is for a book that comes out in March. So this is 5 months ahead of time. So you can kind of get a sense. There really is no downtime. Even though my work with Bluebirds, my writing work ended last July, there is all this behind the scenes work that is going on between other things I'm working on. I have a new book idea that I'm playing with. So I it's almost juggling, and my balls are all at a different place in the air. And each time I get to work, I get to move the balls slightly more in a different location?
We don't have to get real specific with this question, but I'm sure we have listeners who are dying to get a sense. As a published author, I'm sure that brings in some sort of income. Could you maybe talk generally about, you know, how that income helps your family once you have a book published?
Absolutely. And I'm going to be candid and tell you this too, because kids are always asking me this when I do school visits. And so this is what I like to tell them. They like to say, how much are you making? How much does an author make? Are you like a, one boy said to me, are you as famous as Justin Bieber? I said, no, and I never will be. But you have really no sense of how this works, or you're, you know, you have a book on the shelf, so everybody must know you. Well, no, not exactly. But I will say this, you know, I started my teaching in the mid-90s. I'm no longer teaching now, but I started my teaching in the mid-90s in one of the poorest states in the country, New Mexico. And my first book sold for less than I made my first year teaching in the mid-90s in one of the poorest states. So this is not, unless you are highly, wildly successful and have a number of books that come out one after the other, as far as sustaining yourself on this income, it's not especially easy. So I'm fortunate that my husband has a job and that I'm contributing to our family. But I've always said, financially, I'll know that I've been successful if I can keep my boys in glasses and if I can pay for the braces, and the braces are starting up in January, so that's going to be a biggie. And then also if I could recover the couch. I know these sound ridiculous. You know, we put in a backyard and we paid for a new bathroom as well. But I'm fortunate that my contributions are not the sorts of things that, you know, I'm not putting food on the table. And so that's hugely liberating. It means I can pursue some of my ideas that might not necessarily be hugely commercial, but might really speak to my heart. And so that's a nice thing. So covering the couch, the teeth, and the glasses, that's what I'm all about.
Sounds good to me.
Yes, those sound like excellent goals. We've just started glasses over here at our house, so thankfully, and my little boy's only 3, but he needs glasses, but hopefully braces are a long way off.
I'd like to say too, I mean, yay for supportive spouses.
Yes.
That
mm-hmm.
even if he didn't quite understand all these years or had empathy for you with those rejections and no's that came in the mail, but yay for spouses that will support your dreams and your goals, and that's fantastic.
And I'll have to say, you know, to this day, my husband will say, I don't know anybody who can just take something negative like you do and put a positive spin on it. You know, I would get these rejections that would just tell me this and that and this and that, but I could pull something out of it like, well, she did say that I did this well. That's amazing to me that you can go through this process again and again and still pull some sort of nugget out of that and use that as encouragement. And so that's a good thing.
Definitely. I love your maniacal optimism. I think, you know, I'm keeping that phrase in my mind for, you know, I think I let way too many just little things, you know, maybe get me a bit down or whatever, but maniacal optimism, that's something we can all aim for.
Absolutely.
You're definitely maniacal, Bethann.
I am maniacal. I just don't always have the optimism. I have huge ideas, but I don't know. Sometimes,
Just teasing.
Maniacal. Which, I don't know, Caroline, did you know that we're sisters?
Yes,
sometimes. Oh, okay. Sometimes people don't know that, and then they'll hear us, like, make these jabs at each other on the podcast, and I think they're like, whoa, how are these two working? How are they working together? And it's like, no, we've been doing this our whole lives.
Perfect. I love it. Is there something I can add to something you asked me earlier?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You were asking about maybe something like resources for people who are looking for agents or editors, and I'd written some things down, and of course, I was just flying by the seat of my pants. I didn't look at what I'd written down. So I can add a few more things. Some ideas for those people who are ready to make the leap into looking for an agent. There is something that is on Twitter right now. I'm not really familiar with it because I'm kind of an old fogey at this point. I've got my agent and I'm not paying attention, but I am familiar with this term. It's called pitch wars. So it's hashtag pitch wars, like pitching a ball. And this goes on, gosh, a few times a year. And agents will, with this hashtag, say what they're looking for. They'll say, you know, I really am interested in representing middle grade fiction. Middle grade is for 8 to 12 year olds that would interest boys. Or I'm really looking for young adult literature that, gosh, I'm drawing a blank here, but you know what I'm talking about. So these agents will get very specific in their pitches. And then from that, you know the exact agents to target when you have a submission that's ready. There's also something called the SWIM, C-W-I-M, which is the publishing Bible is probably the best way to put it. It's usually $25 to $30. It's published every year, again, by Writer's Digest. And it is the Children's Writers and Illustrators Market Guide. So that's what CWIN stands for. And it is basically like an enormous phone book, a collection of everything from the magazine market, which I know has really shrunk in the last few years, the book market. It has a collection also of agents that are looking to represent authors. And so you can see, for example, you can look through my most recent book, Bluebirds, is coming out with Putnam, which is part of Penguin, which again is a part of Penguin Random House. And so you can look up Putnam. You can see what editors work there. You can see what they're looking for, the guidelines to submit to them if they will take unsolicited submissions, which would be mailings directly to them as opposed to going through an agent. And it's just a tremendous guide. You really, through this, get a chance to see kind of those flavors of each individual imprint and what they're looking for. Also, a really great way, you need to do a bit of detective work, but it's kind of fun, a great way to find out about specific editors and agents. Authors can read the acknowledgments section of the books that they love. And oftentimes, you'll see authors will thank their agents or their editors. And from there, if you're reaching out to a particular agent, you might say, you know, I just read, oh gosh, here's one I love, a historical young adult novel called A Northern Light. Oh, which is so beautiful. So if, for example, you write literary young adult historical fiction, you might say in your query letter to an agent, I just read your Northern Light and I'm writing something along the similar lines. Perhaps you might be interested in my work. As just an example. Also, something that is free and I really recommend people sign up for is Publishers Weekly Children's Bookshelf. This is an online publication that comes to directly to your email box on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and it's basically just industry news. Who, you know, the big authors and what they're doing, the books that are coming out, articles about the publishing industry, interviews with editors. And then at the very bottom, there is a listing of recent books that have sold, which editors have purchased the books. There's a synopsis of the book, who the agent is. And so you really get a sense of what is currently selling, what types of books people are purchasing, which editors are interested in certain types of books. It really, really, really is a great resource.
Caroline, you are just a wealth of information. Thank you so much for that. And my other question is, when are you going to start a mentorship program for other aspiring authors? Because really, I'm just listening to this going, oh my goodness, I think there's people who would just pay you to have you kind of take them under their wings and, you know, show them the ropes. I'm so impressed with everything that you know about this world.
Well, thank you. It really has been trial by fire and lots of trial and error, but I love it. And I do, one of the neat things about being a part of this SCBWI, the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, I'm currently in a volunteer position within my state. I'm the assistant to the person who heads up the entire state. And it's been really, really satisfying to be able to give back. For example, in 2 weeks, we have our annual conference, which again is another benefit for an organization like this. We have two editors, one agent, and one art director coming into New Mexico for a day and a half to meet with those people who have registered for this conference, which again is just such a huge boon when you know, the writing life is largely solitary. And so when you do make these connections with other authors and then have the opportunity to meet with industry professionals, it's a really big deal. But it's really satisfying for me to kind of be on the giving end. And I think back to who I was and just how little I knew. And so it's really exciting for me to kind of reach down and help people along the way as well.
Well, as we wrap up, Caroline, do you have a funny mommy moment that you could share with some of our listeners?
I do. And first, I need to say, my boys are 11 and 13.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're probably not mommy anymore.
That's okay. But, you know, what's my 13-year-old still calls me mama, and I love it. The 11-year-old calls me mom, but the 13-year-old calls me mama, and I love it. But anyway, the 13-year-old, for years and years, he's really known how to kind of get on my nerves, and this is something that boys love to do. He knows to get on my nerves by using bad grammar. And, you know, it's the former teacher slash author. It just gets me. And so, you know, I've gone through phases where I've corrected him. I've gone through phases where I've ignored it. And now I normally just kind of like to talk back to him with bad grammar for fun. And so I told him a few weeks ago, I said, oh, Noah, you know, I was just wrapping up this book that I turned in at the end of September. And my main character is largely based on Huck Finn, which has been so incredibly fun just to have this rascally sort of boy character. And as you can probably think, he's got awful grammar. So I said, Noah, oh my gosh, this book I've written, you're going to love it. The grammar in it is awful. And my 11-year-old, he said, oh, he got really serious. He said, Mom, you can't do that. Kids are going to think you're really dumb. I said, you know what? That's okay. It's for the story. And going back to that idea with maybe the truth, you know, you need the character's truth. And that is what is most true for this story and for this character in his world. And so even if kids think I'm dumb, Jasper is going to speak with awful grammar.
What do your boys think about the fact that they have an author for a mother?
Sometimes they think it's kind of fun. Other times they're not very impressed. You know, it's like any kid would be. I think there are times where they'll say things like, so how many books are coming out next year? I mean, that kind of gets them excited. But I'll tell you, you know, these first two books, they're about girls. And so for years they've said to me, why can't you write about a boy? So, you know, this book about the Klondike Gold Rush with this character, Jasper, who's like Huck Finn, boys, I wrote this book for you. And you know what their response was? Mom, why does it have to be historical fiction again? You know, they're not super impressed. But there are times they think it is kind of cool. You know, I've gotten them a bookmark or two signed by an author that they know, or I've got some, you know, a few autographed copies of books. So they think that part is pretty awesome. But the rest is just rather ordinary.
Well, Caroline, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. I feel like I can just tell everyone who's even considering writing a book at some point, you have to listen to this episode. Caroline will just walk you through everything you need to know. She'll help you get there. But as we wrap up, what are the best ways that people can stay in touch with you via social media or just your website?
Absolutely. My website is carolinestarrose.com, and star is my middle name. It has two R's. It's going to be strange when you type that, because when you put it next to Rose, that will be three R's in a row. But carolinestarrose.com. I blog there too, about 3 days a week. And if you are interested in learning more about writing, if you click through to my blog, I've got one of my tabs is called The Writing Life. And so there is a lot of information about, and also I think I have a tab called Publication. So peruse my blog. There are some things there. And I would love if you join the conversation. I'm also on Twitter. I think I'm C Star Rose. And then I also have a author Facebook page. I think it's Author Caroline Star Rose. But those are probably the easiest places to find me.
Which, by the way, I think Caroline Star Rose is just an awesome name for an author.
Isn't it fun?
Yes.
It's perfect.
I thought for sure that you had made up your middle name, or you know what I mean, or like added it. Like, is it Emily of New Moon that
has Emily Starr?
Yes, Emily Starr. It's been forever since I read those books, but yeah, I thought for sure. I was like, oh, she just added that too.
Well, let me tell you a little aside here. When I was in middle school, it was the worst name in the world, because all of my classmates would say, oh, are your parents hippies? Do you have sisters named Moonbeam and Sunshine at home? And it just would kill me. But now I rather like it.
I do too. This has been so much fun. I'm so glad we were able to talk with you today.
Thank you. Likewise.
We really learned a lot from Caroline today. I was always curious about the publishing journey, so it was really interesting to hear from her how that all works and how it all comes together. If you missed any of the resources she mentioned in the episode, then head on over to brilliantbusinessmoms.com/54, where you can find the very detailed show notes that will take you through all of the resources that Caroline mentioned in this episode. Talking with Caroline just makes me want to go pick up a good book. So I think that's what I'm going to do. Now it's your turn to head out there and be brilliant.